Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Before I begin, I want to apologize for some of my donors. I'm way behind on my thank you notes. I make it a point to write personal thank yous for everyone who gives money. There's been a lot going on, very little of it good. And as always, ask for your support to the extent that you both can and that you, in proportion to what you've gotten out of the program. I'm behind on things like taxes and my electric bill is suspiciously high. I tend to think that yet again, the electric company is using estimated rather than actual bills, so that's going to be a pleasant fight I have ahead of me. So I ask for your support in every way, any way you can. I'm also debating the idea of applying for tax-exempt status, since this is a monastery and I'm clergy and it's all quite legitimate. I'm not sure if that might solve at least some of my problems. I'd like to get your input on that, since it's bureaucratic, and anything that's bureaucratic, I'm ignorant. So, regardless, speaking of bureaucracy, though, we're going to talk about one of the greatest rulers of the Middle Ages, the very early Middle Ages, and that's the Emperor Justinian, Saint Justinian, actually, Justinian the Great of Constantinople. He is one of the most significant human beings in the Middle Ages, or maybe even you could even say the late antique period, but he is a man who partakes of both eras. He died in 565 after one of the most extraordinary, both in terms of accomplishment as well as difficulty, reigns in European history. And it's significant to say that he's probably the last major Emperor of Rome, New Rome in this case, that really thought that a unified Europe and a unified Christendom was in his reach. Really, the 6th century was a zenith, really, of the Byzantine Emperor. The internal regime was consolidated, very much like Putin in Russia had to consolidate and stabilize a state, and then from there, his agenda could be approached. Justinian sought to expand the Roman state to its previous borders, including Western Rome, which had been in a state of anarchy for several centuries. While his uncle, Justin, was emperor until 527, he still comes from an Illyrian or Balkan peasant family. But Justin didn't have any children, so in good Roman fashion, he adopted Justinian, and he became the emperor. He both had a physical strength, a mental strength, we'll talk about here in a minute, but prior to becoming emperor, he became the head of the imperial guard. He was a brave man. He participated in many campaigns, and before being emperor, he won fame as a warrior. Knowing war firsthand, when he declared it, he knew exactly what he was doing. He's no politician. He was a man of great willpower, of great education. The legal tradition of Europe to this very day could, to some extent, be traced to the great Justinian. In good Byzantine fashion, he was no respecter of persons. The nobility, as such, wasn't really a legal category. The Senate, which did exist in Constantinople, was really irrelevant, thanks to the work of Constantine. Constantine was well aware that the Senate was the Achilles heel of Rome, and the very symbol of oligarchy. Procopius, in his so-called secret history, stated that with a calm and steady voice, he could order to kill tens of thousands of innocent people, which was used as propaganda against him later. Unfortunately, given the anarchy to which the Roman world had fallen in his time, the use of violence, unfortunately, went with the territory. And he never knowingly killed innocent people. Very few people are actually innocent of anything. Most people, at this point, make a comment about Theodora, his wife, who had a strong influence on him, a lot like Eleanor of the Romanized French province of Aquitaine, one of the most significant regions of the Western world in the early Middle Ages. She was a striking personality. She was a dancer, and I don't mean that she did swan-like. She was also a courtesan, but she possessed not only a rare beauty, but an intelligence, and a will even stronger than Justinian that gave him his backbone in some of the worst times in his reign. She was no Hillary Clinton, though. Far more moral, far more intelligent, and far less Machiavellian, she did dive into the administration. She received foreign ambassadors. She even wrote diplomatic correspondence. Under Justinian, the empire grew almost twice its size, and he brought the borders very close to the furthest extent of old Rome. The farthest extent, excuse me. Theodora became a political force in her own right, in the Mediterranean, and Justinian made it a point to refer to himself as emperor of the Alemannic, Frankish, and a long list of other westernized peoples. People who were descended from the original tribes that at one time pressed on old Rome's northern frontiers. So-called barbarians. The word barbarian really comes from the fact that they didn't understand the language. It wasn't a pejorative like it is today. He was really underlying Rome's claim to supremacy in Europe, almost claiming to be Europe. And this was generally accepted by most at the time and wasn't challenged until much, much later. It was not a pretension, but it was a simply realistic appraisal of what Rome actually meant to people. Byzantium was the largest and wealthiest state in Europe and much of the world, but it also became a cultural locus of many civilizations, including the Middle East, North Africa, Persia to in a limited way, Russian, Bulgarian, Serbian, Latin, and Greek, and these are just some more important ones. He strengthened the one thing that Rome is known for, and that's the rule of law. Now, the rule of law by itself isn't good, it isn't bad, it just depends on who makes the law. But he made sure to explain that he doesn't so much make the law, he discovers it. Constantinople became the center of the medieval world. And he created the artistic and architectural styles of places like Old Rome, Ravenna, Nicaea, Thessaloniki, all these very powerful cities in their own right. Now, Justinian will always remain controversial. By the time he turned 45, he had experience in politics, and he took the throne at 45, which is not the worst age. Any younger would compromise experience. But he was always a peasant. And the so-called aristocrats at the court, he was seen kind of as a yokel. But of course, the yokel couldn't easily be challenged, so they didn't say this openly. But more than anything else, his overarching concern was the centralization of sovereignty and command. But as he's rebuilding Rome, this is unavoidable. He was completely focused and disciplined, which comes from his army days. He wrote a giant mass of correspondence. He threw himself into his work. He slept little. He ate little. He was truly an orthodox ascetic. And he has been canonized, by the way. But if he was to take responsibility for New Rome, he had to manifest sovereignty in his very person. If you can't rule yourself, then you certainly can't rule the state, which is something that moderns never ask themselves. This is why scandals with politicians are such a problem. If you can't rule your own passions, then how can you rule anything else? So ruling yourself, self-control, was the first, if not the ultimate political virtue. But even his enemies praised his generosity, his mercy, care for the poor. But the royal idea always is that power is a burden. It is not a gift. It is not something to be pursued. The minute someone wants power, he exposes himself as the last person who should be given power. But like most monarchs, especially at the time here in Byzantium, his position was always more or less insecure. His reign, like most royal states, had checks and balances attached to it. Given Roman politics, he did see conspiracies everywhere. That's not exactly paranoia. But all Roman emperors were insecure on the throne. But the more power they were granted, through military victory or whatever, the more the crown looked like a prize, and generals received more and more incentives for usurping it. He had a weakness for flattery, like all of us. But, and this is something that really taxed the patience of Tsar Nicholas II, the last of the Roman emperors, he oversaw the morality of the administration. That's no easy trick. For the same reason. If you can't rule yourself, you can't rule anything else. And if you can't rule yourself, you don't know what you do if it comes from reason or from passion. That's a big problem. But given his position, he would relieve men of a bureaucratic post, for example. And if corruption was uncovered, he would then confiscate their property, which is something that Procopius mentions in great detail. As many of you know, the Nika Revolt in 532 was one of the most trying times of his reign. And by the way, this may be a two-parter. I have 30 pages here, and I don't think I'm going to get through the whole thing. Anyway, a lot of people ask me about the circuses of New Rome. They were different from the Old Rome. Horse racing in the circus was still a big deal. I mean, Constantine sought to create a mini version of the Old Rome in Constantinople or Byzantium. And the circus and the horse races were at the center of social and political struggles. The stadium was one place where people of all ranks could be seen and mingle in the same place. But the first and most major challenge to Justinian was to be found here at Nika. Nika is, it means conquest. That Jesus Christ conquers, for example. Nika is to conquer, or to win, or to be victorious. And the circus parties, had nicknames, the Blues and the Greens, and they were often at odds with one another. And like everything else, because it was in the capital, they took on a political cast. But Justinian was in the process of rebuilding the state, and so taxes were fairly high. And it was at the stadium where the crowd, I don't think their initial drive was some abstract political issue, but that's what it came to be interpreted as. Now, they did damage to the city in the riot, which doesn't make much sense, because I'm not really sure how doing damage to the imperial city is going to lower taxes. But they started a fire that burned the entire city center, including the basilica. But this is where Theodora came into her own, because as Justinian was going to flee, Theodora said, "You're not going anywhere," and forced her husband to stay and fight. And it turned out to be one of the great turning points of global history, because he was able to get enough elite forces together to crush the rebellion. And the man who was in command of this was Belisarius, a man that will soon play a central role here. But the fire, to some extent, was a positive thing because it permitted Justinian to begin rebuilding quite literally, which was symbolic of his entire mission. He was laying the foundations of a new world, the specific mission and role of Constantinople in the world. But the circus party, or I should say the horse races, they did represent two specific factions, speaking very generally. Now, the races themselves were ruled over by the elite classes. Blues versus greens also even had a religious cast to them, because the green had a tendency to be Monophysite. Justinian was a blue in the sense that he was both royalist and orthodox. Greens were the party of the Senate. They were the moneyed elite, while the blue, the landed and military class, what we might call vaguely the middle class. But the revolt ended up being a blessing in disguise, not just because Justinian proved himself, not just because he met Belisarius and realized his ability, but he didn't just crush it with violence. Once the smoke cleared, this was the genesis of his administrative reform. The first thing he had to do, though, is buy off the Persians, the perennial enemies of Europe and the Greeks. He didn't give up on the idea of taking the West. In fact, he did a lot of this at the same time. Unfortunately, I mean, it's Monday morning quarterbacking, but it was an error, because it really became impossible to keep the West under an Eastern Empire. So what later emperors eventually did was develop alliances with local forces that then would recognize the Roman emperor as sovereign, and that didn't require direct rule. In fact, it didn't require rule at all. But the Roman Empire was the template for all political legitimacy throughout the Middle Ages. But it doesn't matter anyway, because the main threat to the empire lay in the east, not the west. The campaigns of Justinian were, they were victorious, but they were also very expensive. In 533-534, Belisarius smashed the Vandal stronghold in North Africa. And I can't stress the significance here enough. 535, Belisarius invaded Italy. Again, somewhat of an error, but he after initial successes in Sicily, he went up the boot, so to speak, and then you ended up with attrition campaigns that the empire could not afford. Now, the court itself was luxurious. Justinian rarely left the palace, but he lived a very ascetic life. He was a shrewd politician, but ideas dominated him more than anything else. He knew how to recognize people with ability. His entire world, his entire life revolved around the idea of New Rome, and he called on others to make sacrifices towards this end and did not spare himself in the process. But by the time his reign was over, the kingdom was exhausted. Now, Persian power was growing. Kutso, who threatened Byzantium, was the new military commander. But besides that, Roman authority did collapse in the west, and Justinian, and Kutso realized this, spent a huge amount of manpower and money to unify the two halves of Rome, that is to say, Europe. But even worse than this, the nomads of the east, like the Huns, the Avars, and even some of the Turks themselves, and even some of the Slavs, could be used by the Persians as an advance guard. And they didn't hesitate to do this. But as far as the nomads were concerned, the Huns and Avars in particular, it had more to do with who offered them the most money. And Byzantium will eventually give them the settled life and all the rewards of the Roman Empire. Beyond that, the fall of the Western Empire meant that the Western market was vitiated, and Western cities fell into disrepair. So what had been a unified empire was now essentially an unsettled patchwork of tribe and cultures in the West. But after the Arian heresy finally fell to pieces, the Monophysite one took over. And remember, at the time, there was absolutely no separation between political and religious issues. So as Belisarius and Narses, who was his successor in the field, conquered the West, they destroyed the Ostrogothic and Vandal kingdoms, he still had to fight the Bulgarians and Persians to the north and southeast, respectively. And war with Persia, as you might expect, continued pretty much throughout his entire life. Kutso I, who ruled until 579, was really pretty much the equal to Belisarius, and it was only his skill that kept the eastern provinces intact. And Bulgaria, don't forget, was reaching hegemonic status in the Northern Balkans. Now, stretching along the Danubian border was a chain of almost 80 fortified towns. But even that wasn't sufficient. Different hordes, usually Huns with some East Slavic groups attached to them, would break through this chain and attack Balkan territory, even came close to the city itself. And this is the background, essentially, of Justinian's legal reform. The state had to be such that it could fend off multiple attackers at once, still manifest justice in the law, and consolidate sovereignty while still maintaining relatively low taxes. And that's a tall order. Now, as many of you know, law was one of his big issues. Remember what law was. In the ancient mind, law wasn't something that restricted some kind of natural abstract freedom. At the very least, it was an acknowledgement of the limitations of human will. And even more than that, though, the affirmation of the divine ordering of the cosmos. Law was the uncovering and, over time, the purification of natural law through experience. Men searched for law in human affairs, no different than a scientist would seek for the law that governs the growth of the human body or a bacterium or something like that. Freedom was not a default state of affairs. Freedom, as I've said many times, was achieved only after hard ascetic labor. Because you could be enslaved from forces from without. More commonly, you could be enslaved from forces from within. See, a passion, it doesn't mean enthusiasm like it means today. The concept of a passion is something that controls men rather than being controlled by it. We get the word patient and passive from it. And normally they include lust and greed, which often are smushed together in our minds. But arrogance, even cowardice, self-will, all of these are deviations from what human reason was meant to be. And the whole purpose of a law code in his mind was a way to make war on these passions, at least to alleviate their nasty effects. His code and the digest that were derivative from it, because this was a massive multi-volume enterprise, reflected what New Rome was supposed to be. It was the framework from which and upon which Rome was to conquer the whole of Christendom and unify it. Now, the law consisted of four elements, and I'm talking about the code itself. The institutes, these were the systematic, meaning logically coherent, expression of foundation. These are the axioms. And they come under general theory of law, which is the first section. Then, essentially, common institutes, you know, the regimes of property and private security, personal security, that kind of thing. And then claims and principles in procedure. And this is the birth of what we, even today, would be modern legal theory. Except that it's based on nature. And it's the institutes that are the most theoretical. And there's really no distinction between law and justice. In fact, the two words are related. But justice doesn't make any sense unless there's some authority to both manifest and enforce it. The most vague, I shouldn't say vague, the most general, foundational concept of justice and natural law is to render to each man his due. To give to each person what they deserve. Notice that mercy doesn't have a role here, but that's why the monarch had to be free. Now, legal knowledge is the same systematic discernment of divine will, human needs, and what is the essential attributes of a just and unjust act. Technically, a law can't be unjust, since if it's unjust, it's no longer a law. It becomes just a arbitrary decree. Now, the second part is the digest. Now, this was the bulk of the code. And this is what gave the greatest challenge to everyone. This was meant to be a systematic, coherent compilation of the greatest of all Roman jurists, whether it be Julian or Ulpian. And you have experts there, excerpts, I should say, that come from just thousands of Roman documents going back to the foundation of the city itself. You could see it as almost a kind of encyclopedia of Roman jurisprudence. But it's no dead letter. It reflects contemporary priority. So ultimately, this was a systematized fragment of legal cases and precedent and ideas from civil law. And this means, to the extent that they were consonant with the axioms of natural law, these come from experience. Natural law in and of itself doesn't tell us how to behave. It tells us the state of affairs that should be after we behave. So the principle comes while it's interpretation. Let me put it this way. Principle comes first, natural law. Then the interpretation of that. And then the ideas in terms of its practical functioning. And these form a hierarchy. The third element is the codex. This is also very substantial. It comes to almost 5,000 imperial laws under almost 800 titles. And this will also include church law, procedure, public service, precedent. And the point was to take all of this and make it orderly. You're showing consistency and you're showing respect to tradition. But tradition is nothing more than congealed experience. So you have the acts of past emperors, great senators, people like Cicero, ancient customs, the tradition of the Republic as well as the Empire. And the assumption behind all of this is that history is not accidental. Rome is the apogee of history. It's the unfolding of true law, the unfolding of human nature and manifestation of justice. So Rome then was the epistemic apex of Europe. Finally, the novella. And this is your most practical, and it deals with the writings of previous emperors, what we would call today executive orders. So putting together these imperial decrees, edicts, this is more practical, more experiential. But again, it has to be coherent. You even had local governors of provinces in here. So you have this immense, profound, this colossally significant codification of Roman law. What about, jurisprudence, history, legal thought, religion, philosophy, all treated as this unfolding cosmic procession. But laws can never be arbitrary and still be laws because human nature is as much part of the cosmic order as anything else. And this cosmic order operates on eternal laws that come from God himself. And human action is one part of this. Since we're not above nature, we must follow our own natural order. So, in 528, Justinian put together a special committee under the great jurist Trebonian. And it was his very patient work that created this code. And Europe, to some extent, was born, legally speaking. So within a year, but 12 full volumes had been approved. And, up until this point, looking at Roman law, you saw contradictions, you saw different time periods, you saw different traditions. And he realized that Trebonian was a man to bring this into coherence. It was human nature becoming conscious of itself as law. So one of the axioms we read from the Institute, civil law is thus distinguished from the law of nations. Every community governed by laws and customs uses partly its own and partly laws common to all mankind. That's natural law. The law which a people make for its own government belongs exclusively to that state, to that nation, and is called civil law as being the law of the particular state and people. But the law which natural reason appoints for all mankind obtains equally among all nations, because all nations make use of it. And the people of Rome, then, are governed partly by their own laws and partly by the laws which are common to all mankind. You will take notice of this distinction as occasion may arise. Now that's from Book 1, Section 2, Part 1. Now this is pure natural law doctrine. A nationalist has to remember that the law, the civil law, exists on an ethnic basis, which is what they say here. St. Photius was to say the same when he was talking about the nature of autocephaly. And it's from here that the concept of autocephaly really takes its origin, legally speaking. nations existed, ethnic groups existed, and had a political element, and that element came from civil law. But since human beings kind of need the same things, I mean, they're rational, they need a rational economy, they need to understand God, they need to understand art, they need to understand how reason operates. These are true for everybody. And this is how Rome viewed itself. Rome was never a nation. Empires aren't nations by definition. There might be there has to be an elite class speaking the same language. But an empire is a confederation of nations with a strong head. The Roman emperor was to be sort of the ethnarch of the Greek nation, but also the manifestation of natural law so that the nations within the empire can grow according to their own internal lights and experience. So you have a balance between national sovereignty on the one hand and natural law on the other. I should say national sovereignty and natural law. The very nation, the very concept of nations coming into existence and developing their own sense of self is in fact part of natural law. It's not an accident. So even nationalism doesn't make any sense without the universal conception of what a human being is. A human being is rational, but he's also rational in a context. You have to be rational about something. It's interesting to note that he truncated the use of the death penalty, because here, punishment wasn't really to harm the offender, but at a very minimum, it was to restore the authority of the law. So it was to rebalance the crime with the victorious imposition of natural law. So it reasserts itself. The law binds the ruler as a Christian, but it also permitted saints like Ambrose and Theodore the Studite to challenge emperors that overextended their power. And this law code was used to crush much corruption. It ended one of the great errors in church life, or the purchase of the office of bishop. And the great thing about Orthodoxy, Christianity didn't render the Roman law void, but it revealed the true origin of law as such. Roman law now made sense, and this was essential to the institute. And this is the birth of Europe. It doesn't make any sense without Justinian's law. The historical illiteracy of these pagans have no idea what this was. The old pre-Christian customs were maintained and codified and made coherent now that the origin of the natural law makes sense. We know who created it. And being responsible to God was something taken seriously at the time. And the emperor knew he'd be judged for this. So the point of punishment was at a minimum to bring balance back to the state. Because crime was an unnatural act. It was irrational. Now the phrase absolute rule it's an anachronism. It's really a misnomer. Even if the Byzantine idea of the crown meant that the emperor should be free to do what he pleases, the reality of technology, communication, infrastructure made direct rule pretty much impossible. The concept of state then and now have very little in common. Only the modern state can track its people's movements 24 hours a day. Justinian had no video cameras. He didn't have hundreds of thousands of intelligence operatives. He didn't have social security numbers. And Justinian looked over a bureaucracy that was maybe a hundredth of the size of the bureaucracy in the state of New York. So you talk about absolute rule or tyrannies in the ancient world, just laugh at them. These guys couldn't be tyrannical if their life depended on it. But the concept of absolute doesn't mean he could do as he pleases. God, how many professors define it that way? They're idiots. The term absolute means that the emperor is the physical manifestation of law as a part of the natural order. It could never be arbitrary by definition, because nature isn't arbitrary. The conventional existence of the bureaucracy, when I say conventional, meaning that the bureaucracy is only indirectly associated with natural law. The existence of the bureaucracy, the military, the monasteries, the bishops, guilds, and even a merchant class, all of these, in their different ways, placed substantial limits on even the highly limited abilities of medieval monarchs. The emperor could never tell anyone to commit sin, could never command anyone to be cowardly, could never command anyone to abandon the faith, could never command the rejection of the law, could never command the rejection of the church. And these limitations cover pretty much all areas of life. The idiots in the universities will talk about checks on the state. However, the real question is, where were the checks on big money? And that's what the state was. And Justinian acknowledged that the code was binding on him, not just as an emperor, but as a man and a Christian. The only time any monarch, when understood in the Justinian kind of a way, Justianic kind of a way, was in the interest of righteousness, then he could change something. So, for example, and this is very common, the law on paper may command that all debts have to be paid. Well, that's a good principle. That's a good axiom. Because the very fact that they're debts mean they have to be paid. However, Justinian and many emperors, or Nicholas II being a big one, Alexander III too, they violated the letter of the law so as to forgive the debts of the lower classes. Now, of course, this would never happen in a modern republic, but happened all the time in monarchies, because this so-called violation of the law served the general good. And this happened all the time. If the law was to be damaged by these high debts, then the debts would be repudiated, and only the emperor could do that. The consequence of the code was that now the royal state could control big money. And no matter where we talk about, the nobles, whether military or civil, are always some of the most vehement opponents, especially the civil elite, of the common good. Because any monarchy cuts them out of authority, and they're forced to serve the common goods of civilized life. And usually that's too much for men of this type. Once they're cut out, once they don't run things, they look to rebellion. And that, of course, is a matter of the passion of dominance. Centralization of power also meant that the local elites couldn't hold people as serfs. The expansion west and the constant war, unfortunately, meant that Justinian needed money all the time. Now, the money economy at the time was limited. Taxes came from the rich. They're the only ones who actually use money. And the proof of all this is that the elite violently reasserted itself after Justinian's death. The peasantry worked in kind, so the money economy was only a matter of the elites, and therefore they had to cough it up. And canonical issues were also, I mean, Justinian's main real passion, the real love, passion in the sense of enthusiasm, was theology, and he was very talented. In 535, he wrote a novella to the Patriarch of Constantinople, Epiphanius, and it was very comprehensive. The marital status of the clergy, church property, bishops, their residences, obstacles to ordination, religious education, all of this. But the canonical reforms of Justinian became the standard for Roman and Greek churches to this very day, although the Church of Rome has largely abandoned them in practice. Technically, they are obligatory for all Christians. But public ignorance makes this impossible. In the introduction to this novella, this is where Justinian makes his very famous statement, "The greatest gifts of God showing his supreme benevolence are the priesthood and crown, the sacred and the imperial power." And nothing could summarize him better. The divine law orders the mind of man. For the law of the crown, coming from natural law, more abstractly, orders his daily affairs, to the extent that they are legally important. Both come from the same source, and they give human life its purpose and end. Kings really are meant to remove obstacles for piety to develop. And of course, the monastics, not only are they economically significant, but they're a connection between the divine and the human. When the priesthood becomes blameless, the kingdom will enjoy a legitimate authority rather than arbitrary power. That's the nature of the symphony. That's the ideal, and it can't be removed from any analysis of Justinian's legal policy. Now, I have many essays and broadcasts on what the symphony of powers is. It's used all the time defined very rarely. Unity is his final aim, which really you could define this as the agreement of the material and the spiritual. And this is really a prerequisite for any justice at all. See, heresy is a sin against a coherent cognitive system. Heresy is a problem because people's actions come from their beliefs. A true system of law can have no contradiction. So if you were to follow the Monophysite heresy from a strictly legal point of view, it's a sin against God from the theological point of view. But from the legal point of view, it was a sin against the unity of the empire. It's not to say that Justinian opposed theology in its essence, but that really wasn't his job. Unity cannot be achieved by relativity of doctrine. It satisfies nobody. Traditional mentality inherited from the Roman Republican state had a dominant role throughout the history of the empire. Power was always conditional. Authority is not, but power is. Essential to political science is a distinction between power and authority. And this is why no one ever talks about it in the university. The emperor stands as really the only vehicle for the grace of legal organization, and other legal institutions are derived from his will so long as that will is consonant with natural law. Now, despite some tradition pointing to some hereditary transfer of power, there was never any valid legal scheme for succession, which is probably a good idea. Things are too complicated for a scheme like that. The Byzantine system of government was focused primarily with the problem of ensuring the integrity of the multinational empire. That is to say, when I say multinational, I mean literally a series of nations. This has nothing, there was no such concept of integration. That's strictly postmodern nonsense. But the state was Greek. Just like the Pope of Rome is the Bishop of Rome as well as the head of the church in the Western point of view, the emperor was both the Greek ethnarch and the head of the empire. Again, this has no meaning unless he is consonant with the law. And the law has to serve righteousness. Now, in principle, any ethnic group could occupy the highest positions in the state. And it's a multinational state. It doesn't stand in the way of unity. But you still had to have a unified government. They couldn't be speaking different languages. But unity was to be found in the Greek language. Now, Latin had been the dominant language up until roughly a bit after Justinian. The institutes, these were mostly written in Latin. It didn't last long, though. But the Greco-Latin language, orthodoxy, the law, and loyalty to Rome, this was the manifestation of unity. The Byzantine concept of justice is based on the understanding of the law as general will of the population itself. Again, and that so long as it's contiguous with the divine. Now, the status of a person, that is to say, a citizen, not an ego, not an individual, but a person, does not derive from membership in a social group, but citizenship exists as such. So the rule of law meant the formal equity of all citizens, regardless of any status. Since Byzantium regarded itself as the legal center of the world, its presence helped create the notion of formal rights as part of the institutes. Though not necessarily enshrined as titles, each person has a certain legal status, but it needn't be permanent. Basic provisions governing personal and political status of each citizen still, though, derive from nature. And the very obvious ones, there is a right to life, education, marital status, the right to bequeath and inherit, participate in various contracts, judicial protection, procedural status, for example. The code is not normally interpreted as a body of rights, but they can still be discerned. Rights only exist within law, within nature, within a web of obligation. Western peoples like to talk about rights. They don't like to talk about consequences. So the law was meant to help centralize power and strengthen the economy. enhancing trade and expansion was absolutely essential. Constantinople was also the center of world trade. In the rich cities of the empire, you had a rise in craft production so long as macroeconomic stability reigned, and you had a growth of high tech, which really involved at the time construction equipment. And this meant that Justinian could rebuild cities, erect urban palaces, fortifications, border areas. The Western Empire really had been torn to pieces, and its separateness, even after the attempts to take the West, or to take Italy, Byzantium entered into a period of stabilization. The waves of barbarian conquest, whether it be Western or Eastern, Northern or Eastern, I should say, kind of bounced off the walls of Theodosius and ricocheted off into the West. Because you couldn't do anything. The walls were, 100 feet thick. There's nothing you could do about it. And you had people whose job it was to constantly go around the walls, making sure that every little crack was repaired. Parts of it were about 20 feet thick. Some were far greater. The economic recovery that began under Anastasius, a bit later, was really created by the qualitative increase in internal and external stability under Justinian. So you had increased and more rational tax collection, more efficient tax collection, and being able to exploit wealth-rich cities like Thessaloniki. Because without money, you can't reform anything. Of course, you need reform to get money. That's where leadership comes in. Now, Justinian was quite willing to negotiate with the Senate, but it doesn't take long to realize that it's futile. And I mean that literally and as a pun. It's not an exaggeration to say that the code really developed as a way to crush the power of this class. I mean, he wanted to work with them. But he always realized that to do this, he had to also undermine his economic power. And his power was to be found in his large estates. And as I said before, the secret history of Procopius talks about the confiscation of land of his opponents. So the land tenure of the Senate was something that, just like Ivan the Terrible in Russia, Justinian had to undermine. The aristocracy didn't want to give up a penny, and therefore they hated a strong crown, which wasn't in their interest. A strong crown was in their interest, but at the same time, it meant that their power was relatively less. They didn't care about the overall health of the empire, even though it was in their interest to do so, and were willing, like you see in Poland and elsewhere, they were willing to harm the strength of the empire if it means they gain. This is almost a universal constant in politics. He hated the notion of regional states growing up within the empire, and weak emperors did see this. Now, Procopius will then backtrack in his secret history and say that, well, the Senate really didn't have much power, but he didn't talk about the personal fortunes of senators. Again, the emperor wouldn't attack his opponents and waste precious resources on people who have no power. But what he wanted to do is what you saw in Russia as a outgrowth of the Roman emperor, to make them dependent on a center rather than opponents. There's very little in political history that's more popular than taking on the rich and powerful. And so republicanism was to come from the senatorial rule in early Rome and become the rule of oligarchy later on, and now it's almost the official ideology of the West in the perverted postmodern world. Another universal constant is that middle landowners normally loathe and envy the very rich. Monarchies from China to London have hired the services of this kind of middling class against the wealthy. And they're the backbone of any empire, really. And the international contacts of the highest noble power create kind of a very cosmopolitan, very condescending class who then starts talking in universal terms, like the universal right to property, to justify its wealth. So whether it be Bulgaria, Russia, Byzantium, the middle lords became the mainstay of the state, and that's international, in the army as well. The so-called middle classes of all sorts, the guildsmen, even some of the Italian merchants, held the protection only in the crown, not local strongmen. So what Justinian wanted to do economically was create what we would vaguely call a yeoman class of farmers. slavery was being gradually abolished, and part of this was to crush the slave gangs of the very wealthy. You see, slavery really only worked in Rome if you owned a million slaves. Owning one or two slaves didn't make it. This was the case in the South, too. It didn't make any sense to own a handful of slaves. This was an economy of scale issue, because free labor made a lot more sense. They had more incentives. A slave only wants to work so that he doesn't get punished. But if you give a free worker financial incentives, he'll work far harder and more effectively. The more free labor that is used, the less power the elite have. The more free labor that you use, the better the yields seem to be. So there was something along the lines of progressive farming that was being used at the time. There was kind of the yeoman landowner who had every incentive to make sure that his land yielded quite a bit. This was a civic-minded group. This is long before Jefferson came into existence. The slave armies of the upper nobles kind of created this cosmopolitan, conspiratorial outlook in the world. You see, because the high elite have far more in common with the high elite elsewhere than they do even with their own people. The middle landowner is not a comrade, he's a competitor. And the state is the same way. The problem with wartime was that open fields were usually burnt, their inhabitants fled behind city walls. So, like anywhere, you needed to repopulate abandoned areas to attract small landlords for abandoned land, and even the cultivation of wasteland in certain cases. So the long-term lease was favored, and it was in the code. And when this happened, suddenly the wealthy weren't so interested in universal property rights. Because property rights were only for them, not for lesser people. So the only real requirements was the payment of a tax, and then the owner was given wide latitude. So then you had a huge incentive for improvements in agriculture and disincentives for the slave system. And if you released your slaves, Justinian would offer the long-term lease idea. And then you would have no choice but to develop the newer methods of farming which he was promoting. The long-term lease system created this loyal class of middle landlords who had their taxes lowered, and because of that, they had certain immunities granted to them. And then you saw a rapid repopulation. And this included merchants of the cities, too. Middle-level peasants, former soldiers, former slaves, dispossessed landlords. This was part of his success. But moderns have trouble with this idea, because moderns still have this superstition that more money means you're better off. At this point, if you believe that, you're a fool. But academics are fools, so. In the 5th century, you did find a grain crisis. And this goes along with instability in general. So undermining the slave owners became absolutely essential for him. And it was his reforms that was your first attack on slavery. And it came from Christianity, it came from natural law, and it came from the necessity of building a strong economy. So he restricted, as only a strong emperor can do, the growth of manors. That manor is manorialism and feudalism are two different things. Most people think feudalism is manorialism. It's not. Manor is a very large estate. Manors often have private armies. Manors often even sometimes coin their own money. This was out of the question. You saw that in Russia just before Ivan the Terrible. Again, the crown had to lean on this middle landowning class. And they did go to the government for protection because the magnates had no interest in law. Then they cared about money and their title to it. The state was only good insofar as it protected that. So higher elites would find every possible loophole and pretext for seizing land. That meant that the middle classes of landowners developed a strong love for the strong state, the really strong institutions. Unlike modernity, the state was more powerful than any high magnate. And they were really too insecure with one another. They never trusted each other either, so their combination was often a challenge for them. And this served Justinian very well. Without a strong state, the tendency of government, the tendency of society is towards oligarchy. That's what's so stupid about the so-called state of nature theories. That's not how it works. You remove the law, you have strong men who come into existence, who then attract more and more people as servitors for the sake, at least, of protection. That's what happens when law is eliminated. But the state of nature stuff is utter nonsense. Unfortunately, modernity is based on the state of nature nonsense. I mean, that alone, if you're listening to this, will give you a way to approach modern political theory negatively. Tell these people, go to a libertarian, and say, explain to me how locked state of nature works. And then you say, yeah, is that really what would happen if there were no law? Of course not. I mean, if anything, Rousseau makes the most sense in that respect. But when you have patronage, nepotism, the private armies of the elite, this is a sign of decay. And not only that, the loss of confidence in the state. For all of its faults, bureaucracy was far better than the rule of oligarchy. Because without the bureaucracy, without law, elite patronage networks is all that would exist. That's the state of nature. Ethics, the state, government, exist and only have legitimacy to the extent that they fight these things. Because without law, patronage networks is all that would exist. That's why the libertarians are all wet. To think that the state and big capital are enemies is to be, well, the policy restricting the power of large landowners, really, again, it's an ongoing battle. Bureaucracy wasn't bad, especially when you have strong law. You're never quite certain of their loyalty. And he always, I mean, governments always have to make concessions. And if Putin has had to do it, you have no choice in the matter. And the more war that goes on, the more chaos that's created, and therefore the more you need these people. The more chaos that's created, the more that ruthless people are rewarded. That's the state of nature. So middle lords became the mainstay of the state, and it became the mainstay of the state, you know, almost right up until the foundation of the U.S. Unfortunately, the world of 1780 no longer exists, so the Constitution doesn't make a lot of sense anymore. So, he had them, though. You want state protection, you have to give pretty much unconditional support to his plan for conquest in the West. And he was hoping that these circles could be tempted by the idea of a victorious campaign against the Western barbarians. And he wasn't mistaken, but their interest, unfortunately, is always short-term. The middle yeoman, so to speak, the old Roman patriotism still existed. They wanted to get some of the spoils of the conquered provinces. They were certainly fascinated by the idea of Roman superiority over the locals, but they did want a piece of the pie too, which is not entirely unreasonable. So his plans of conquest did have a broad response, but once Belisarius developed, was bogged down in a war of attrition, then the sacrifices became too great. The Orthodox Church became one of the strong social buttresses to the wealthy as well. They had no reason to oppose the state to. They had high standards of justice. They generally believed in centralization, the spread of the empire, and for protections of for landed property against the wealthy and vice versa. Like the middle classes, the church also, in a state of nature, would be a victim of the rapacious elite. So protecting the land holdings of the monasteries became very, very important. And that meant that these became exempt from taxation, and largely because they were already involved in tremendous social service and education. And the other thing is that they were excellent husbandmen. So a lot of progressive agriculture came from them. So the monastery's immunity from taxation also meant that they were used as a buttress against the elite. Like you see in medieval Germany and elsewhere, the monasteries became the mainstay of the state, but they were also the first to turn against the emperor. They were very literate, they were very cohesive, and when the emperor became a heretic, as happened all the time, they were the first to pull their support. To think that the church was this slave of the state is a joke. You have to be incredibly ignorant to believe that. Remember, the first millennium, you had far more heretical emperors than you had Orthodox ones. And the only reason that these heretical emperors were checked was the monastery, was the local synod. There were always slave bishops that would do whatever they were told, but monks weren't like this. Monks always were the mainstay of piety. Without monasteries, there is no church. Without monasteries, there is no bishop. All right. I'm at an hour here, so I need to stop. I'm on page 10 of 30. So now this will be a part one of a two-part series. I will be back next week with part two of this, and hopefully, there's so much material here to understand what Rome is to understand what Europe is, to understand what Christendom is. This really is the legal, ideological zenith of what Europe is. And if you don't understand that, well, then you don't know anything, because Europe is based on this stuff. Law, rights, duties, etc., come from Justinian's Code. It all comes from Justinian's Code. So we will finish this up next week. Until then, please, I ask for your assistance. Thank you for listening, my friends who support me, and my enemies, dumb as you do keep me on my toes, and I appreciate that very much. Thank you, I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.